Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A reckoning on race. The U.S. grapples with what to do with Confederate monuments as the calls for overdue justice grow louder. Then, new voices, members of Generation Z, discuss coming of age in tumultuous times of protests and a pandemic.
We are the generation that says no more. And I think that we will be the generation that revolutionizes this world and transforms the world for the better.
Plus, it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks consider whether a political shift is underway over race and the role of police, along with the latest moves in the race for president. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The drive to reform policing in America is gaining more momentum. New York State moved today to ban chokeholds and to release police disciplinary records. Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the changes into law in Albany. He also said he will tie state funding to local action.
We're not going to fund police agencies in this state that do not look at what has been happening, come to terms with it, and reform themselves. We're not going to be, as a state government, subsidizing improper police tactics. We're not doing it.
Meanwhile, Louisville, Kentucky City Council enacted Breonna's Law, banning no-knock warrants. It's named for Breonna Taylor, who was killed by police inside her home. And President Trump said that he would favor ending police use of chokeholds, except in limited circumstances. He also demanded again that the city of Seattle end the occupation of its Capitol Hill neighborhood by protesters. In the presidential campaign, Mr. Trump defended his plans for a campaign rally on June 19th in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The day is known as Juneteenth and commemorates the end of slavery. And Tulsa was the site of a white-on-black massacre in 1921. But in a Fox News interview, the president dismissed the criticism.
You can really think about that very positively as a celebration, because a rally to me is a celebration. It's going to be really a celebration, and it's an interesting date. It wasn't done for that reason, but it's an interesting date, but it's a celebration.
Mr. Trump also plans to accept the Republican renomination for president in Jacksonville, Florida, on August 27th. On that date in 1960, a white mob attacked black protesters in Jacksonville, an incident now known as Axe Handle Saturday. A federal appeals court in Washington heard arguments today over ending the prosecution of Michael Flynn. The Justice Department wants to drop charges against President Trump's former national security advisor. He pled guilty to lying to the FBI in the Russia probe and then tried to withdraw the plea. More U.S. businesses got the green light to reopen today, from bars in Iowa and wineries in Northern California to the San Diego Zoo. But Utah and Oregon delayed further action as COVID-19 infections keep growing. Still, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said that it is not yet clear what is causing the resurgence. Officials cited several possible factors during a teleconference.
Sometimes an increase is driven by increased availability of testing. Sometimes it's driven by outbreaks, and we've seen outbreaks in certain occupational settings, in long-term care facilities. Early on, we saw clusters of infections in shelters for people experiencing homelessness.
The CDC also posted guidelines that had been expected for weeks. They range from avoiding elevators to safely attending concerts. They do not address such issues as going to church or dating. New protests erupted in Hong Kong today, marking 1 year since a violent clash with police. Thousands of people demonstrated at busy shopping malls. They carried banners and chanted slogans calling for Hong Kong's independence. Riot police stood by, and there was no word of violence. The Prime Minister of Lebanon held emergency cabinet talks today, and the central bank agreed to try to shore up the economy amid nationwide protests. Beirut woke this morning to streets covered in shattered glass and broken storefronts after clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Back in this country, the Trump administration formally ended protections for transgender people against discrimination in health care. The final rule defines gender as a person's biological sex. An Obama-era rule defined it as an internal sense of being male, female, or some combination. And Wall Street managed a partial comeback from Thursday's rout. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 477 points to close at 25,605. The NASDAQ rose 96 points, and the S&P 500 added 39. Even so, it was the worst weekly loss since late March. Still to come on the NewsHour, an interview with the only Black professional NASCAR driver as the U.S. grapples with its racial history. Members of Generation Z discuss coming of age in tumultuous times of protests and a pandemic. Mark Shields and David Brooks examine a critical moment in America, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
More than 150 years after the Civil War, monuments, schools, and roads across the country still honor Confederate generals and leaders. But in the midst of the recent protests demanding racial equality, there's a renewed push to take down the monuments. In a moment, Amna Nawaz will talk with the man who led the drive to have NASCAR ban Confederate flags. But first, Lisa Desjardins looks at how the death of George Floyd has prompted louder calls to remove public symbols of the Confederacy.
It is perhaps the greatest dismantling of the Confederacy since the Civil War in Richmond, Virginia, in Birmingham, Alabama. Confederate statues removed or protests demanding their removal. New Orleans.
We're all going to bring the movement forward.
Jacksonville, Florida. Across the country, it is a direct extension of the protests against racism after George Floyd's death.
I think what's happening right now in the present moment is that people are really beginning to understand what we mean by the structures of white supremacy.
While some argue the monuments honor Southern ancestors, Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center says most went up either early in the 20th century or during the Civil Rights era, as racist groups like the Ku Klux Klan flexed their muscle. Some have come down before, like the Confederate flag off South Carolina State House grounds following the murder of 9 African Americans in a Charleston church in 2015, and statues removed after a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. But Brooks senses something different now.
I think we're in the midst of a real inflection point. I have never seen such a multi-racial, multi-ethnic coalition of protesters demanding an end to anti-Black racism.
For some, the monuments are an important start.
You were traitors. You attempted to secede from the Union, then had the audacity to lose, and then put up monuments of your loss? That feels like a great lie. And racism is what has allowed it to be a lie.
For me, a lot of these monuments represent times that members of my family and my culture and my race have suffered.
By removing these statues, it's going to give people an opportunity to really re-examine the history of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and Jim Crow, and all that went with it.
According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, at least 1,800 sites across the country commemorate the Confederacy, either with a monument or place name. Among them, 10 military bases named for Confederate officers, including Fort Bragg in North Carolina and Fort Hood in Texas. Defense Secretary Esper has signaled he's open to changing those names. Retired Army Colonel Mike Jason wrote an op-ed to Pentagon leaders this week.
I've seen the emails and the paperwork. I've spoken to commanders and peers and colleagues. and they're ready to make this happen. They're talking to soldiers, they're generating options and alternatives. Great men and women have served this country, and they're excited to do this.
But President Trump himself has vehemently pushed back, tweeting, "These bases are part of great American heritage, and his administration would not even consider renaming them." But this week, the Senate Armed Services Committee, led by Republicans, voted behind closed doors to require renaming those bases within 3 years. Mike Rounds, Republican of South Dakota.
We don't want to forget what's happened in the past. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we should continue with those bases with the names of individuals who fought against our country.
But Congress faces an issue under its own roof about the statues in the U.S. Capitol itself.
11 statues memorialize Confederate leaders, including Confederate President Jefferson Davis and Confederate General Joseph Wheeler, standing just a few feet away from a plaque marking the spot of Abraham Lincoln's desk in Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this week asked for Congress to now take all the Confederate statues off display.
Can you imagine Jefferson Davis, Alexander Stevens, treason? They committed treason against the United States of America, and their statues are still here because their states put them here.
Republican Senator Roy Blunt, who oversees the committee responsible for the statues, says moving them is possible, but only the states can take them out of the Capitol. And some states are, like Arkansas, about to replace its controversial statues with musician Johnny Cash and civil rights activist and journalist Daisy Bates. It is a cultural turn. NASCAR this week banned the Confederate flag from its events. The Navy and Marine Corps have also just banned the flag. But some worry this is a slippery slope toward the removal of monuments to founding fathers, many of whom were slave owners. Others say the country needs to be more educated about its racist past.
I don't agree with the wholesale removal of everything that pertains to the Confederacy, because we need to understand what our history is. It's that we don't need things that glorify that history.
They need to be put in a historical context that they're not being put into. And there's so much work and healing to be done in this country. It's just, it's really not possible when you have people worshiping these symbols of oppression.
The Confederacy survived for only 4 years, but it has shaped discrimination and divide for generations since. Now, again, a test of how long its symbols will stand. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Now for NASCAR. The decision to ban the Confederate flag represents a major shift. The flag has long been a hard-to-miss presence at races. This photo shows some flying at a Homestead Miami Speedway. This was back in 2018. Now, the driving force this week pushing for the ban has been Bubba Wallace, a driver in NASCAR's top series who's been elevating the issue of racial equality in that community. At recent races, he's worn shirts with the message, "I can't breathe." And Wednesday evening, he raced 500 laps in a car sporting a special Black Lives Matter paint scheme. NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace joins us now. Bubba, thanks for making the time and welcome to the NewsHour. I want to ask you about this decision because it happened pretty quickly. It seems like within days of you making that request, NASCAR said all-out ban on the flag, but they've wrestled with it before. I remember back in 2015, they encouraged fans to stop bringing the flag and the fans ignored them. So why do you think they did this ban, an all-out ban now?
Well, good to be talking to you, first of all. Really, it's something that needed to be done. Since then, obviously, way before then, we were trying to get this change going. And like Dale Jr. said way back then, the flag belongs in history books and museums now. And I'm proud of NASCAR for stepping up and taking that action to get rid of the flag.
Do you think that there's something about this time that we find ourselves in right now that said to them, this is something we have to take? It's not enough to encourage fans to stop bringing it. We have to just ban it.
Yeah, for sure. I had conversations with NASCAR leadership, simply Steve Phelps, the president, and talking about how we need to take, affirmative action to get rid of the flag immediately and just do a whole culture shift with the sport. Our sport has this such bad stigma about us, and I want to show that we can provide so much more than the history's past and make this about inclusion, diversity, unity, and coming together as one.
Well, let me ask you about the future of the sport, because it's worth noting, like a lot of sports ratings, NASCAR's been in decline, right? Viewership has been going down. Do you think that their concerns about turning away or alienating potential new fans were part of their decision right now?
Actually, the stats we've been getting, the viewership's been going up. So we've, you know, obviously all sports have gone down from across all boards, but our sport seems to be, you know, kind of leading the forefront. And then us being the first sport back after this COVID-19 pandemic really shows the leadership that we have and how we can take on what's new for us and create the new normal for right now. So fans are going to start coming back soon. And I'm excited for when it's back to the old ways of fans being able to come up and purchase the ticket and enjoy the race, because that demographic is going to be a lot different than what we've seen in the past. That's my hope. And I truly believe in that the change has started and is coming and still in full form.
What do you mean by that when you say the future demographic is going to be different than you've seen in the past?
It's just going to be a different face, I feel like. We've always talked about having more diverse background, a diverse fan base in stands. People of all races and colors going to be there to support their favorite driver. Doesn't even have to be me. But just being there and enjoying their time, cheering on their favorite drivers, buying their merch, eating the concession stand, just having a good time with the family. It's a family sport, and we encourage all families to come out and have fun.
Bubba, it's worth pointing out to anyone who doesn't know that you are the first full-time black driver since 1971 in NASCAR. And you mentioned before that you heard from some first-time racegoers. They came to races, they saw the flag, and it made them uncomfortable. You didn't want anyone to feel uncomfortable. But what about you? In all your years participating in what's an overwhelmingly white sport, did the flag ever make you feel uncomfortable?
It didn't. You know, I always had the mindset, and maybe I was blind to it, of just going out there and chasing checkered flags. And now being more open and more of a leader on the matter, it's not about me. It's about the people I'm representing, my fan base. I want my fans. I encourage my fans to come out to races. And if fans have problem with something, then it's I feel like it's up to me to stand up for what's right, and to create equality and make everybody feel comfortable going wherever they are. That's what's wrong. We're so afraid of stepping outside of our box to enjoy, you know, the unknowns. And you know, I'm a person that lives life on the edge and has no holdbacks. And I encourage people to do that as well. But when there are certain things that we can control as people, that's holding a different demographic back, then let's just come together and meet in the middle and get rid of it.
Bubba, I got to ask you, because we're having this conversation after millions of people watched the video of George Floyd dying, and you shared recently that you have seen it, that your mom saw it, and that she sent you a message after that. What was that message?
Yeah, she just said she hopes, she prays that she'll never have to see me lying on the ground saying I can't breathe and that my life matters to her. So that was a pretty impactful message. And, you know, that just pushed me to keep doing the things that I'm doing off the track to change the world.
Can I ask you what you first thought when you saw the video?
It was disgusting to see. And I was hurt. I was hurt for 2 or 3 weeks prior to that over the Mont Arbery video, being hunted down and killed in broad daylight. So I've been feeling a lot of hurt and pain and anger, just like the African-American community has. And so this was just the tip of the iceberg where we're simply tired of trying to peacefully protest and say something and nothing happened. So you see all this chaos and whatnot going on. We're tired. We're hurting. We're in pain. The African-American people are trying to speak out and say they want change, and change is coming.
But very briefly, in the few seconds we have left, there are people who are going to look at the ban and say, okay, this flag is important to me. It's part of my heritage. If NASCAR is done with the flag, I'm done with NASCAR. What would you say to them?
It's tough to change the simple-minded people, people that are stuck in their ways and don't want to adapt to change. That's tough. But a good friend of mine, Marty Smith, ESPN, said NASCAR's not closing the door on you. They're opening the door to many others. And that stuck out to me. So it's pretty powerful there.
That is Bubba Wallace, a driver for NASCAR, joining us tonight from North Carolina. Bubba, thank you so much for making the time.
Yep, thanks.
Your PBS NewsHour podcast will be back in a moment. First, a message from our promotional partners at Volt Studios.
Selena Quintanilla Perez, aquí está con su éxito.
At 23 years old, Selena was on the verge of superstardom. But on March 31st, 1995, those dreams would be cut short after a fateful encounter with her close friend and the president of her fan club, Yolanda Saldívar.
Does it make you angry when people talk about, people say that you are obsessed with her?
Selena, A Star Dies in Texas, a new podcast from Vault Studios.
Why do you believe Selena was killed?
America's youngest labeled generation, known as Gen Z, those born in the late 1990s and early 2000s, enters adulthood as the nation grapples with systemic inequities in our institutions, from policing to health care. The NewsHour Student Reporting Labs, our journalism program for high school students, spoke to teens across the country about how they see this moment.
A lot of times you hear people say, oh, all lives matter, when they try to counter the Black Lives Matter movement. So my question for the people who say this, when will there be equal opportunity in America for all races?
How are we as a country going to eradicate this issue of racism when it has been so deeply rooted in our government, our society, and the history of America? What is our next step?
When are we going to see and address a health disparities? Disparities in education. We currently live in a country that is embedded in institutionalized racism for over 400 years. The time is now to create change.
I just wonder, why aren't people more compassionate? Why aren't people doing more? You know, we're all Americans, we're all people. So why should I have to be treated less than?
I don't wanna grow up to have kids and have them being scared because of their skin color.
It feels like there are so many people right now who just don't really bother trying, or who don't understand at all. And obviously a white person never truly understand that, but how do you get them to just recognize that life is different for Black people than white people in this country? Because that seems like something that so many people are in denial of.
I've donated, I've signed petitions, and I've been posting on my social media, but I'm wondering what else there is that I can do to support the social justice movement, because I feel like I need to do more and I have a responsibility to take more action, but I don't know how to do that.
With all the people who are screaming out for change, will there be a change? I hope to God there is a change.
To build safer and stronger communities, it's gonna take everyone to combat racism in America. You have to have conversations with your friends, your family, your colleagues, and it's going to be hard, but the conversations are definitely worth it.
So, as we're hearing, America's teenagers are asking tough questions. Some of them are also offering policy solutions. Stephanie Tsai spoke to two young Black Lives Matter organizers about why they're protesting and their vision for change.
In the wake of the latest killings of unarmed Black men by police, a new crop of young leaders is emerging. They're part of Generation Z, and with their bold calls for dismantling traditional policing and other systems, some say they hold the keys to lasting change. I'm joined now by two young organizers. 16-year-old Ta'andiwe Abdullah, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles Youth Vanguard, and 17-year-old Jalen Thompson of O'Fallon, Missouri. Jalen was one of the lead organizers for his city's protest. Thank you both so much for being with us. Jalen, not only did you help to organize the protest in O'Fallon, Missouri, population 88,000, but I understand this was your first protest. Can you describe what that day was like for you?
For me, it was just very, very surreal, I guess is the best way to say that. This has been kind of a breaking point, seeing that we're just now graduating and leaving into the world. So it's scary to think that this could be us someday, and that's why we we're so happy to see so many people coming together to kind of start having this conversation, even in places where it's not often talked about.
Jalen, there's a picture of you at that protest holding a sign that simply says, "I am human too," which is a powerful statement. But another powerful statement is that you were arm in arm with O'Fallon's police chief. Can you describe what that felt like, especially when so many consider the police to be the problem?
Well, here in O'Fallon, we definitely have a much better relationship with our police officers than in a lot of other places. And I think that's why we're working with them to kind of keep the protests safe. It's not all of the officers that are the problem, but it's the system that they operate under. They are able to do these things that they do that are sometimes inhuman, basically. And they're able to get away with a lot of it because of the way that our system works. And that's why we need to change it.
Tan Diwe, you've been organizing and at protests in Los Angeles, which is one of the places where police have been criticized for how they've handled protests. And we've seen numerous videos of police actually being violent toward peaceful protesters and journalists and even bystanders. So I wonder how you read when a police officer is part of a march or takes a knee.
I view this as a systemic problem. I don't believe in the good cop narrative. I believe that there are good people who decide to become cops. But in choosing to do that, I feel like you are choosing to join an oppressive system.
We've heard two phrases, defund police and abolish police, become popular in recent weeks. I wonder what you think about the effectiveness of that language.
What I think that a lot of people mean when they say defund or abolish police is we need to reimagine what safety looks like. It's not like we don't that we don't want law enforcement or that we don't want security for our communities, but we need to reimagine what that looks like. Someone imagined this world that we live in today. And so I think we need to think about, you know, really taking the time to think of something different, right? We have imaginations. Let's use them. Does safety look like community-based security? Does safety look like mental health? Does it look like affordable housing? Does it look like the security guard that works at your school? We really need to just take that time to dream of something better.
It's going to be hard. And just like with all of the defunding the police and kind of reimagining, as she said, with the police that we need to do, it's going to take a while. And that's why we need to be as involved in the fight as we can be starting now, so that down the road, in a few years from now, we're still going to be there.
Tan Diwe, I want to play a short clip of you at one of the protests. Take a listen.
I'm graduating this year. And the world that I am about to head up into does not want me.
Absolutely heartbreaking to hear the sentiment that you feel in that video, Tan Diwe. I wonder if you can talk about how the trauma of continually seeing unarmed Black people shot and killed by police has affected you.
We do have to start considering the mental health and emotional toll that it takes on Black people to see these videos constantly on social media and even the news now. They don't censor. I remember when I saw Ahmaud Arbery on the news, nothing was censored. It was the complete video of the murder. And it does something to, I think, not only me, but to a lot of Black people, especially considering the generational trauma that a lot of us have in terms of police brutality and just white supremacy in general. And so what it feels like is a war on Black bodies and Black people. And to grow up in this movement, right? Because I've been in this movement since I was very young, and kind of see all of this unfold time and time and time again. It's heartbreaking. And it kind of sometimes makes me feel like this world just wasn't meant for my life to be able to live in.
Our school systems, our economic system, the way that our cities are set up, it's just not. We are meant to be oppressed. We're meant to not have the same opportunities. And people who see those opportunities everywhere for everyone are kind of being led by the system. We're kind of in the circle of police brutality leading to people feeling hopeless, leading to kids feeling hopeless in schools, not only because they see those things, but also because they just don't have the same resources. So for me, it's, I'm hoping that I can kind of be a voice to say that that's something that we need to focus more on, is not only ending police brutality and kind of rethinking that, but also rethinking the way that we're sending our young kids into the world, because a lot of them aren't prepared.
Tan Dewey, there are so many expectations for your generation, Generation Z. And I wonder whether you have hope that this is the moment that leads to permanent policy change.
Yeah, Generation Z, we are fed up. We are the generation that says no more. And I think that we will be the generation that really revolutionizes this world and kind of transforms the world for the better. But at the same time, on the flip side, it is kind of a lot to say that the future of this entire world and this nation is resting on Gen Z's shoulders when we've barely even made it out of childhood yet. And I think it is kind of a little bit of an easy way out for a lot of older generations to be able to say, well, this is on y'all. And, you know, you have to take over when, you know, they're not gone yet. We still need all the help that we can get. And so I think that it does have to be a balance between letting Gen Z and kind of accepting that Gen Z will be the change, but also at the same time, making sure that older generations are doing their part in making sure that our future is bright as well.
Jalen Thompson in O'Fallon, Missouri, and Ta'an Dewey Abdullah joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you both so much for sharing your perspectives.
Thank you.
Now we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you, and let's talk about these young voices we've been hearing. David, Generation Z, the youngest generation, we've just heard them say, we're not going to take this anymore. Things have to change. Can they make a difference with our help or without it?
We have to realize how different their mindset is than those of us in older generations. If you ask people my age or people in the boomer generation or in the silent generation, are people around you trustworthy? Majority of the people my age group say yes. If you ask Gen Z, are most people trustworthy? 65% say no. If you ask them, are most people selfish and out for themselves? 73% say yes. And why is that? Because they've been raised in a society that they feel has been untrustworthy. They've seen the financial crisis, they've seen the Trump, they've seen continued racism, climate change. And so their sense of alienation and disillusion with society at large is what we just heard. And so it's a much more radicalized and much more activist generation. And so they're seeing the world very differently than generations above. And we see that in every workplace. And so they certainly have the motivation to do a lot. One thing I think I worry about is a real dislike of hierarchy, of organization, of authority. And if I don't think unless you can do permanent and institutional change, unless you're willing to build institutions with leaders and hierarchy and authority structures that'll last for year after year. And that's something that's so far been missing from most of the modern social movements.
Mark, do you hear messages, voices coming from this younger generation that you think can end up making a difference in the future?
I sure do, Judy. As a member, hard as it might be to believe, of the silent generation, a generation that wore T-shirts that were white, as Mark Russell put a message on them, I stand in awe of their intensity, of their passion, of their sense of urgency, and their sense of justice. While not disagreeing with David's point, I think to hear that sense of impatience for justice is frankly encouraging and even inspiring.
And David, when you combine them with all the other voices we've been hearing in recent weeks, whether it having to do directly with what happened to George Floyd, whether it's about police reform, is the political ground shifting. Do you sense that things are actually going to change around police reform, around, you know, policies that people are saying we've had enough of?
Well, there's certainly been a shift in attitudes. This has been a remarkable week in shifts of attitudes. If you ask people, do you support Black Lives Matter? 2 years ago, most people said no. And now, by 29 percentage points, they say yes. If you ask people, what do you fear more, police violence or the violence of the rioting and looting, they say, I fear police violence more, by 2-1. If you ask people, are Black people treated unfairly and abused unfairly by the police, after Eric Garner was killed in 2014, only 33% said that. Now 58% say that. So we're seeing dramatic shifts in public opinion as regards to the African-American experience. And that has been one of the positive developments. I think the second positive development is just the peaceful protests. The protests have gone more peaceful as they've gone along. And the protesters have done a better job of quelling violence than the police.
And so, Mark, when they talk about defund the police or abolish the police, are these things that could actually happen? We see Democrats coming forward with all sorts of reform proposals, Republicans holding back. We think we're going to hear more from Republicans in Congress next week. What do you see as the real pressures that could lead to change?
Well, I don't minimize in any way, Judy, the importance of nomenclature and naming in any political debate. It is no accident that much of the resistance to the Affordable Care Act was centered around the term death panels. And if you recall, that somehow people are going to be sent off to meet their maker by some unnamed anonymous medical group who would meet and decide their fate. Totally unfair, inaccurate, but it got a lot of traction. And how you speak, and that's why I say defunding the police. Does it mean disbanding the police? Does it mean, in fact, transferring the obligations that police carry today, who really do carry enormous, awesome responsibilities of dealing with people who are homeless, people who are on opioids, people with addiction problems with alcohol and drugs. You know, they really do have an enormous responsibility. But if it becomes, and I am rather cheered that the Democrats have not gone for the bait in any way. I think, quite honestly, it's been a miscalculation on the part of the White House on this issue, that somehow Donald Trump could roll back to reelection on a law and order basis. But I don't in any way minimize that this is a very explosive situation still.
So, and David, in terms of what really could change, I mean, we're seeing a willingness to accept, for example, bringing down Confederate monuments, changing the names of military bases, except for the president, who said he doesn't want to see this happen. But is it your sense that people are willing? You mentioned the polls, but is that going to lead to legislative change, policy change that will be seen in the African-American community as something that's meaningful?
Yeah, well, if you use the phrase defund the police, you're not asking for change. To me, it's just a terrible slogan. It's counterproductive because it makes everybody think I'm going to have no police. That is not what the American people want. After Ferguson, they asked African-Americans worldwide, Gallup did, do you want a greater police presence in your neighborhood or less? And right after Ferguson, they wanted greater police presence. And that's consistent with poll after poll after poll. People want a greater police presence because more police leads to less crime, which leads to less contact, which leads to less violent encounters, which leads to less incarceration. People generally like the police, but they want it done differently. And I do think there's a possibility to get real changes in that. It's interesting how much even small reforms can make. The communities that have banned the chokeholds and strangleholds have seen dramatic declines in these kind of abusive things. Even a city that said that when there's a chase, the cop running after the person is not going to be the first one to touch the suspect. Somebody else is going to touch the suspect. That alone sharply reduces the number of violent encounters. And so these sort of things can be done reasonably easily. The harder thing on the police front is changing the corporate culture. We have somehow gotten the world where the police are basically like the military. They go to boot camp like the military. They dress more like the military. They have sort of a warrior ethos in some of the departments. And changing that corporate culture can be done. It's been done in Camden and Newark and other places, but it has to be done in cities across the country.
And picking up, not just on that, but on the point about a push to get rid of Confederate symbols, Mark, do you see that happening? Where, I mean, are we now at a moment, a turning point, if you will, where the things that people accepted before are just not going to be accepted anymore?
I think we are, Judy. I think the resistance, strangely enough, is centered right in the White House. I mean, it's no accident that a Republican Senate committee this week voted to move ahead on the removal of the names, of changing the names of American military bases, which were named, let it be noted, long after the Civil War, but obviously an attempt, just like those statues were, to reestablish the proper order that existed before the Civil War. And they were in southern states, whether it's Rucker, Alabama, or Hood in Texas. They were all named for Confederate generals. And I think what you have on the statues is an ongoing discussion and movement, including the Secretary of Defense, a Republican, and the Secretary of the Army, McCarthy, who's a Republican. And the stoutest resistance is not from the Daughters of the Confederacy, but at Donald Trump in the White House, who said there will be no changes. And I quite frankly think this is a total miscalculation on the part of Donald Trump, the president, and his reelection. It is not 1968 when Richard Nixon could run and successfully on the law and order. Richard Nixon was the insurgent. He was the challenger in 1968. The Democrats had been in power for 8 years. 110 American cities had gone up in flames. 16,000 Americans had died in Vietnam that year, and 590,000 Americans were there in an unpopular war. I mean, the law and order campaign had a traction and a believability, which it does not now. And I think, quite frankly, there's a serious mistake that we in the press make, and I've made it myself. When someone wins an election, he or she is a genius. When someone loses, they're obviously a dunce. And we were willing to give Donald Trump all sorts of credit by he has this intuitive connection with the American people. He knows what's going on. That's how he won in 2016, because we didn't see him winning. And quite frankly, he got 46% of the vote, and that's it. And if anything, he's getting a lot less now. I really think it's a miscalculation.
And finally, David, the president's decision to hold this big campaign rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on June 19th, which is the anniversary of the massacre of blacks in that city, coupled with the convention, half the convention in Jacksonville, Florida. What do we make of this?
You know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Trump talking about Henry Ford, and I gave Trump the benefit of the doubt, thinking he was ignorant of Henry Ford's racist ideas. Well, I was wrong about that. He had a full familiarity. When it comes to that kind of thing, he has a PhD. And so I assume Donald Trump knows what June 19th is. And I assume that in the gigantic advance team that it takes to put a convention together, there's somebody who knows what June 19th was, and somebody who knows what Tulsa means. And so I have to think that, and even if they didn't know, they know now, and they could make a change. And so this is just putting a thumb in the eye of basic decency, as far as I'm concerned, and you just show respect to your neighbors. How much of this is not, it's clear. If your neighbor doesn't like a Confederate flag that used to represent slavery, then take it down. If your neighbor doesn't like you hosting a thing in June 19th, don't do it. It's just basic citizenship.
The end of quite a week in American life, American history. David Brooks, Mark Shields, thank you both. as more states push forward with reopening, the coronavirus continues to enact a devastating toll on families and communities across the country. We want to again take a moment to remember a few of the remarkable individuals we've lost. Pecky Powell was often referred to as the unofficial mayor of Evanston, Illinois. For 37 years, he ran Hecky's Barbecue. Their famous sauce was created by him and his parents. Hecky employed kids from all walks of life, and that commitment extended beyond his restaurant to his social work, providing opportunities for struggling youth. The 71-year-old was also a loving father of seven. Anyone who knew Loretta Dionisio could see she was tough. Loretta fled martial law in the Philippines in her early 20s and rose to become a graphic designer and creative director in Orlando, Florida. A cancer survivor, she traveled the world with her husband of nearly 50 years. The pair were inseparable. Around her family, Loretta's toughness melted away. They say she was the sweetest person. Loretta was 68 years old. 75-year-old Zawal Makumbi was focused, cerebral, and stern, but his daughter says he had a soft spot for children, especially his grandkids. Born in the Congo to Angolan refugees, Zawal led protests in the 1970s for Angolan independence from Portugal. After moving to the U.S. in the 1980s, Zawal worked as a school psychologist in Washington, D.C. He was passionate about helping low-income Black students overcome trauma and learning disabilities. Barry Weber was a Renaissance man, a New York City surgeon who could build cars and computers and also loved the ballet and classical music. His wife, Harriet, says he was quiet and mysterious, but confident in the emergency and operating rooms and a great teacher. He shared his love for rock climbing with his two boys, Duncan and Michael. Barry was 67 years old. Marlo Stoudemire was a Detroit community activist and entrepreneur, most recently working with the NHL to introduce hockey to urban communities and schools. Marlo was outgoing, a devoted advocate for underrepresented individuals, but family was his priority. He met his wife, Valencia, in biology class when they were 14 years old. He went on to have two children, Shelby and Ian. Marlo was 43. Our hearts go out to the families of all those we've lost, and everyone who's lost someone in this pandemic. And finally tonight, A Lens on America, millions of lenses, and the whole world is watching in this Race Matters report. Jeffrey Brown looks at the power of the camera to shape and shift perceptions, now and in the past. And a warning, this story contains disturbing images. This report is also part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
It begins with a brutal act, at once explosively public and painfully private, all caught on camera. In the days since the killing of George Floyd, in a world awash with cameras, images of all kinds have galvanized millions. Protesters and police. The Lincoln Memorial under armed guard. A president knowing the power of a photo, creating his own, but also creating a different image that many Americans will never forget, of peaceful demonstrators being forcibly removed. Indelible images, urgent and immediate, but also part of a long history.
The camera has been central in terms of focusing on the issues of the storytelling of the moment.
NYU photography historian and curator Deborah Willis.
I see the camera as a visual diary. It is recording the voices and the images of people who want to make a change. How do we make a change? We have to show the evidence of what's going on in the community.
Evidence through different kinds of images, those of lynchings used by whites to further terrify the Black community. And the brutally beaten body of 14-year-old Emmett Till in his casket in 1955, Photos his mother insisted the world should see. Deborah Willis was one of the millions who did.
I was 7 years old when I first saw the image of Emmett Till in the Jet magazine. I'll never forget that moment. To see that moment, to see it also revisited today as a conversation with the unfortunate death of George Floyd last week. I'm, you know, this is getting a little emotional, but just to see the connection, it really helped us to remember that we need to make a difference.
In the 1960s, the nightly news showed police using water cannon and dogs against civil rights marchers in Alabama. Images direct to the nation's living rooms. In his art and documentary work, renowned photographer Gordon Parks captured a life that much of white America wasn't seeing, and images that could have been taken in recent days. This is the camera as a kind of tool, as a kind of advocacy tool.
Gordon Parks said he used the camera as a weapon to show the stories of injustices. I see that photographers today are doing the same, that they're using their lenses to capture moments to say, we need to make a change. We need to make a difference because we can't live like this anymore.
Ever since the 1991 beating of Rodney King by Los Angeles police, the camera having an impact has often been held by an everyday citizen. More recently, in 2014, a video of the death of Eric Garner in New York gave a further push to the Black Lives Matter movement. In February, Ahmaud Arbery was shot and killed while running on a Georgia street. 2 months later, after the release of video capturing the scene, arrests were made. In May, a black birdwatcher named Christian Cooper taped this Central Park encounter, in a sense, directing his own film.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
He'd asked a white woman to leash her dog, as the law calls for. In this case, the camera was his protection. And of course, social media allows instant dissemination of images to the world.
It's a beautiful thing. You know, for the first time in the history of mankind, the power of the image has been democratized, right? You don't need an expensive camera to tell a story, right? You know, George Floyd, his story was catapulted into the global consciousness from an iPhone.
32-year-old Mark Clennon is a professional photographer who first gained a following on Instagram. In recent days, he's been taking part in and photographing protests in New York.
The camera's a mirror, right? You go, you break down, you open up a camera, it's a series of lenses and mirrors. It's my job to just show a mirror to America, you know, what it looks like right now. And really, as the holder of that mirror, be as accurate as I can and really show that this is more than just a protester. These are real people. These are real humans, real stories.
Clennon says he feels a responsibility in all his work, and especially now, to present a portrait of what it means to be African American today.
I think it's a responsibility that all black artists have to carry. You know, when I first go to a protest, you know, my camera's to my side, and I'm just taking in the gravity of this moment. I have a 3-month-old daughter, and you know, when she's an adult, she's going to say, I was born in New York City, you know, the epicenter of a global pandemic, and now a loud microphone for this new movement for, you know, justice. I've broken down crying at multiple protests. I think why some of the images are so strong and people are looking at me in my eyes because they see, you know, tears in my eyes and the top of my mask is wet because, you know, it feels like, you know, I'm attending a funeral daily.
So much of American history was photographed, documented, written about by white people. Mm-hmm. So how important is it to you to be doing that, documenting what happens now as a black man?
I just want to make sure that we have a first-person account. I want to make sure that the black voice is not left out of this conversation, especially since we are the center of this conversation. We black Americans are taking ownership of our stories, right? We can now educate our peers and educate ourselves as a community. And that is unique. That is the number one differentiator between now and the original civil rights movement is our ability to tell our stories.
A still unfolding moment in American history, being captured one image at a time. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
And before we go, an apology. I misspoke saying June 19th was the date of the Tulsa massacre. It was not. It was the date slavery ended. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe and good night.